Good evening. It's good to have everyone here tonight. We'll be looking at Luke chapter 22. The reading was read for us just a little bit ago. Luke chapter 22, beginning in verse 54. Then they seized him and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house, and Peter was following at a distance. And when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down among them. Then a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the light and looking closely at him, said, "This man was also with him." But he denied it, saying, "Woman, I do not know him." And a little later, someone else saw him and said, "You also are one of them." But Peter said, "Man, I am not." And after an interval of about an hour, still another insisted, saying, "Certainly this man also is with him, for he too is a Galilean." But Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you are talking about." And immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the saying of the Lord, how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows today, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. What I want to look at this evening is the question of why did Peter weep? And I think looking at God's word can give us an idea as to why Peter wept. Imagine meeting Peter after this incident, weeping on the street, and you see Peter and you say, "What's the matter, Peter? Why are you crying? What's wrong? What's going on?" And imagine what Peter would have said. And I can imagine many things that Peter would not have said in that moment. I don't think he would have said, "Hey, that's just how I feel right now. That's just how God made me." But more importantly, I don't think he would have said, "I made a mistake. I made an error in judgment. I missed the mark. I did the best I could, but it just wasn't good enough. I broke one of God's rules." I don't think Peter would have said any of these things. I think what he would have said is, "I have betrayed Jesus." And the nature of the relationship that Peter and Jesus had forged over the last few years meant something to Peter. So much so that Peter claimed just the night before that he would die for Jesus. And Jesus had warned him that he was going to deny him. And Peter had said, "I don't know what you're talking about. Even if I had to die for you, I will die. All of these other people, all of these other jokers might leave, but I won't. I'm going to stay by your side." And Jesus says, "Before the rooster crows, you're going to deny me three times." And this man, Peter, who had the bravery to whip out his sword in the face of a multitude and actually use it in defense of Jesus, when a little girl says, "You were with Jesus," it completely undoes him. And Peter knows the betrayal for what it is. He sees what he's done, and thus he weeps. I think this story really reveals to us the nature of sin. And more than that, it reveals to us a lot about the nature of God, and it reveals to us the nature of forgiveness. It isn't simply a mistake or an error of judgment. It's not, "That's just the way God made us." It's not just breaking God's rules. It is a betrayal of our Creator Himself. There are a lot of places where this is emphasized, and there's an interesting passage in Leviticus chapter 6, and the first part of this chapter is about the behaviors that we engage in towards other people, and it talks about something like stealing a deposit from someone or other forms of stealing from people. And it begins in verse 2 talking about someone who sins and acts unfaithfully towards God and makes the point that all sin committed against one another is actually and ultimately a sin against God. And this is the point of the story of Joseph, or this point is made in the story of Joseph, when Joseph is enticed by Potiphar's wife, and he says, "I will not commit this great sin against God." which is exactly what it would have been. Yes, it would have been a sin against Potiphar's wife. It would have been a sin against Potiphar. It would have been a sin against Joseph. But Joseph doesn't say any of those things. He realizes that ultimately and totally and completely it is a sin against God. And possibly the most famous account in the Old Testament that makes this point is the story of David and Bathsheba in 2 Samuel chapter 12. In 2 Samuel chapter 12, beginning in verse 13. And there it says, David said to Nathan, and notice who he says he sinned against. He says, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. Nevertheless, by this deed, you have utterly scorned the Lord. The child who is born to you shall die. You remember the story of David and Bathsheba. David sees Bathsheba. And he finds her beautiful and he commits adultery with her. And then to cover it up, he has her husband Uriah murdered. Those are all sins that were committed against Bathsheba and against Uriah. But David says that this sin is against God, and Nathan agrees with him. And in Psalm 51, a psalm that is directly related to this sin with Bathsheba, David says in verse 4, against you, speaking of God, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. It's a rather emphatic statement that David makes about his sin with Bathsheba. And what all these passages are telling us is that sin is really a personal affront, an insult to God. And on some level, we all understand this. If we go to the store and someone is weighing out food for us and they put their thumb on that scale and they so that they can overcharge us, no one would say, oh, he's offending the scale. Though in reality, he is, because by putting his thumb on that scale, he's taking this instrument and making it look like it's doing something it's not, making it lie and say a different number than what the real number should be. But we don't really dwell on that, because that's not what's important, because the bigger affront is to me, the person who's buying, who's being overcharged. And this is what David is trying to say in Psalm 51. Yes, of course, David sinned against Bathsheba and Uriah, and in a large part against the nation, since he was their king. But all of that is trivial compared to the sin against God. There's probably no greater moral truth that we could learn than that all sin is against God and is a personal attack against God. Like taking a dagger and driving it into the very heart of who God is. That's what sin is. And that's probably why we try to trivialize sin so much, so that it doesn't sound so bad when we do it. One of the Hebrew words we hear preached on from time to time is the word for sin, which means to miss the mark. And there is some accuracy in that. But really, what is the point of even mentioning that to someone? Because we can leave the impression of someone who is really trying to get that arrow into the bullseye, but the wind blew at the last minute and knocked it just a couple inches off course. So it's still a remarkable shot, but it's just a couple inches off, just barely missed the mark. That's not what sin is. Here we are just tooling along and we're a great marksman, but oh, I just missed a little bit. No, it's a personal affront against God, and that is because of the very nature of who God is. The two go hand in hand. If you trivialize sin, if you make it less than it really is, then you're trivializing who God is. And that is because of the nature of God. And it trivializes the very relationship that we're supposed to have with God and with one another. Notice in Romans chapter 8, as Paul is analyzing this relationship of those who are serving sin and those that are living by the Spirit and serving God, beginning in verse 5, It says, "For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh. But those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. For to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God, for it does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot." Now, this is one of those places where Paul contrasts the flesh and the Spirit. And the mistake we often make here is to look at the flesh as something that pertains to the body. And so fleshly sins would be what we look at, like alcoholism or sexual immorality or anything like that. But as Paul describes the works of the flesh in Galatians chapter 5, we see things like jealousy and divisions and more like that. Because the flesh doesn't really have much to do in this context with the body. But it is the idea that one is only truly alive when they have the Spirit of God within them. The Spirit of God is what truly imparts life to us. Just as in the beginning when God took that lump of dust and he formed it into man, it was just a lifeless lump until God breathed life into it. But more importantly, it is the Spirit of life that we have from God. I mean, outside we can go find a squirrel that has some power that is animating it, allows it to move around. But it's not truly alive because it doesn't have a spirit in it like we do. And then because of our sin, we are no longer alive. We are spiritually dead. Dead in our trespasses and sin, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 1. So how else can you describe a sinner other than merely a corpse? He is flesh without the Spirit. And those who live by the Spirit have that life that is from God. And so there is this mutually exclusive nature. There is no such thing as partly living by the Spirit or partly being alive. You're either alive or you're dead. And so we are either of those who are dead or of those who have been made alive. And so it is mutually exclusive. There's no middle ground. And this speaks to the very nature of who God is. And who is this God? Well, just as in John 8, in verse 44, Satan is described as the father of the lie, of all deception and all alternate reality, God is the father of truth. All truth, whatever is true and real, comes from God. And therefore, sin, by its very nature, is that which is false, not reality, that which does not reflect reality, which attempts to undermine and destroy reality and present a false alternate view of things. And of course, the ultimate truth that has been revealed is what we were created for, to have a relationship with God and with one another. And that is why the greatest commandment is love the Lord your God with all of your being. And our fellow man is ourself. So all of these relationships come into play. And that is why sins that get at the very heart of relationships strike us so deeply as the betrayals that they are. Now, sometimes the sins can get a little distant. So, for example, I may pay more in car insurance because the automotive fraud going on in Fayette County is so high. And I may not really like it, but when I pay my insurance bill every month, I'm not going to go, "Well, that's a betrayal." Because that betrayal is at a greater distance from me. But betrayal that is closer, like the betrayal of a spouse or a friend or a family member, we deeply feel that. We can feel that. And this is the point that the Bible is telling us, that though our perception of sin can be distant or close, God's perception of sin is always immediate and close. And however badly we feel we have been treated or betrayed or hurt, it's nothing compared to the way God feels when he is sinned against. We know that that is one of the most incredible things, that if we could just get it through our heads, that when we're hurting and in pain, whatever it is, and we're wondering, where is God? Why is he letting this happen to me? Does he even care? Not realizing that God feels our pain more deeply than we could ever imagine. And that's true even of our sin. If we think that we have been sinned against or violated in some way, it's nothing compared to the way that God has been feels that sin and violation. That's his very nature. Whereas we are only partly remade in the image of God, we're still kind of limping along, trying to walk in renewal of life. God is perfect, and he perceives reality perfectly, and he is all-knowing. And we can say that he is all-feeling. And everything that goes with that. And so this is the very nature of God. And this explains one of the great travesties in the Gospels about Jesus. If it turns out that all of this is one great fabrication, what do you make about Jesus who goes around forgiving people? For example, in Mark chapter 2, we have the story of the men who bring the paralyzed man to Jesus. And it's so crowded that they have to lower him through the roof. And in Mark chapter 2 and verse 5, Jesus, when he saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, "Son, your sins are forgiven." Now some of the scribes sitting there were questioning in their hearts, "Why does this man speak like that? He is blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone?" And they're absolutely right. Only God can forgive sins. But why can God forgive sins? Because they're against him. Because they are directly against him. And so Jesus goes around Palestine and Galilee, reacting as though all of these sins are committed against him, forgiving people. And that's the only possible way to justify Jesus going around and telling people that their sins are forgiven. Again, it would be a complete travesty that someone suffers some horrible tragedy, like someone breaking into your house and murdering your entire family or something like that, and then one of us going in and saying to the culprit, "Your sins are forgiven." Well, that man is going to look at you and say, "What gives you the right to say that? He didn't do it to you. Why do you think that you have the right to tell this man that his sins are forgiven?" But Jesus acts throughout the Gospels as if sins are committed against him, because they are. And so it isn't merely that Jesus was crucified, which was clearly a sin targeted against him. That's just a microcosm of all sin that is perpetrated against Jesus, and the depth of feeling and hurt and pain. Again, just a fraction of the pain that God has been feeling from the very beginning of time because of all of our sins against him. Because he feels every sin that has been against him. And that explains why when we get to Hebrews chapter 10, that the Hebrew writer characterizes it this way, beginning in verse 26. "For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has spurned the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified, and has outraged the spirit of grace? For we know him who said, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay.' And again, 'The Lord will judge his people.' It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God." You see, God's very nature is opposed to everything that sin represents, and vice versa. Sin is opposed to everything that God represents. And so there are consequences to this mutually exclusive reality. That's the way things are. And we understand this principle in some way. If I go against gravity, then gravity is going to go against me. If I go against reality, reality is going to go against me. And so if I go against God, then necessarily God is going to go against me. Because God's very nature is about life and truth and what is real and all of that, and all of that that represents death and what is not true must be opposed by him. And God cannot be indifferent about lies or death because it's his very nature. Now, if we're insisting on lies, if we're insisting on a reality that is not true, then what do we expect but that God would oppose it? And while we're on the receiving end of that, it won't be so pleasant, but we're reaping the consequences of our behavior. There is actually and this may seem like something terrible, but there's actually a really great comfort in all of this, because he is a God of truth and life. Gravity is a wonderful thing if you cooperate with it. And you can harness its power to do great things. And reality is wonderful if you cooperate with reality, and it will do great things for you. And God is wonderful. If we will cooperate with him, he will do amazing things with us. And we understand this in other areas, but we think, oh, well, because God's God, surely he can just forget about it, just forget about my sins. And that brings us to our third point, and it ties very much into the nature of forgiveness. If you trivialize sin, then you are trivializing God, and if you trivialize God, then you are trivializing God's forgiveness. And this brings us to consider what really is forgiveness. And there's really only two ways we can look at it. There's man's ways of doing things, which is pretty much summed up in the expression, I'll forgive you, but I'm not going to forget. And in essence, that means I'm going to waive the consequences. You're not going to have to do exactly what you deserve to do because of what you did. But you did it. And I'm never going to forget that. And at that point, the relationship between those two people is essentially broken. And we see that in the story of Absalom. You know, talk about David's sin with Bathsheba and the chickens coming home to roost. David's committed this sexual sin, and then David's son Amnon commits a sexual sin against his sister. And Absalom is so upset about it, he plots to kill Amnon. And so basically you have David's sins being repeated with his sexual sin with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah, and Absalom murders Amnon. And Absalom leaves, and he's essentially banished. And what happens to Absalom? Joab comes to David, and he says, hey, why don't you get Absalom to come back? You've kind of banished him, and he's not welcome, and that's not a good situation. And David says, okay. And Absalom comes back, but then what happens? David won't see him, and years go by, and he will not see his own son. The consequences may have been waived, but not entirely, because the relationship had been destroyed. And that's what happens with people. And this is why there is only one possible way to forgive, and that is the way that God forgives us. Instead of this no consequences, but I won't forget mentality, God says, yes, there are going to be consequences because sins have to be dealt with, but I'm going to forget. It's the exact opposite. If you care about somebody, truly care about them, and genuinely have a close relationship where you care about them more than you care about yourself and what it ought to be, when they do something to you, you're going to forgive them, and you're going to understand that they need to learn and grow from this experience. So there are going to be consequences. But you're not going to keep bringing it up and remembering it, because we want the relationship to be nourished and to be what it ought to be. And God will forgive us more deeply than we can even imagine. And we count it all joy when we fall into these situations where there are consequences, because we know that the testing of our faith brings forth a spiritual maturity, and it strengthens our character. And this is where the triviality comes into play. Because when we have trivialized existence in it's all about this life, and material stuff. And so when somebody sins against stuff, it's not that important unless somebody's stealing your money or your material stuff or hurting your material stuff somehow. Then it's really important. But because the ultimate reality and the ultimate truth is eternal and all about God and a relationship with Him, and sadly, when we trivialize that and sin and God, then we have also trivialized this whole business about forgiveness. If we would understand what's at stake in eternity, then we would understand that sin is not a trivial matter at all. It is an offense personally against God because He is the source of all truth and all love and all this relationship we have been created for. And He sacrificed Himself for us. His love is seen so clearly in the cross, and He has forgiven us. But there's still a tough road ahead for us. There are difficulties that we will face. There are weaknesses that we have in our characters that must be strengthened. That is a spiritual reality. That's the life that we're called to. And so coming back to the story of Peter, here's Peter who has betrayed his friend and his Lord and his master. Here's Peter who had walked on the water and made the greatest confession that Jesus is the very Christ, the Messiah sent from God, finds himself unable to muster up enough courage to stand up and admit Christ to a little girl at the door. And that exposes the depth of his betrayal. And he goes on and weeps bitterly because he has betrayed his friend. And when we truly come to realize what sin is and what it means to God, then we will weep bitterly when we see that it is not simply just a small matter, but it is a betrayal of the very God who created us and loves us and died for us. We cannot minimize our sin because to do so minimizes God and His forgiveness. So in closing, I don't know what your situation may be, but if you are living your life apart from God, if you are living in sin, then that's a serious matter. And you need to come to understand that. You need to understand what that does to God. But the reality is that His love is so great that He wants to have a relationship with you. He wants to have you part of His fold, to call you His child. And maybe you are a Christian and you're following Jesus, but you stumble. You need to realize the seriousness of the sins that you've committed and realize that you need God and you need Him and His forgiveness more than anything. So that's our invitation this evening. If there's anything that we can do for you this evening, we ask that you come forward as we stand and sing together.